is the One Ocean Hub podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the One Ocean Hub podcast. And this time you can also see us, and we are not in our usual place. We are in Cape Town at the closing conference of the One Ocean Hub. And with us, we have some very special friends today who are going to talk about some very important issues and some central issues in our work. My name is Nilit Brokit. I'm a knowledge exchange associate at the One Ocean Hub. With me today are the small-scale fishers from South Africa, and we're going to speak to several of them who come from different parts of the country but share one common struggle and have some ideas of how some of that plight can be alleviated. And with us today as well is Maria Hornick from Worldwide Fund for Nature, where she is a lead for Coastal Communities Initiative. Welcome, everyone. We are also here today with Hilda and with Bradley, and we're going to talk to a couple of other people in just a few minutes. As I said, you are the representatives of small-scale fishers from South Africa, Hilda and Bradley. Could you, Hilda, tell us where you're from? And could you, Bradley, tell us where you're from?
My name is Hilda Adams. I am from Mamre. It's a small town on the west coast within the Western Cape. I am the chairperson of our newly registered small-scale fishers cooperative. And then I am also the liaison person with the fishers organization, South African Fishers Collective.
Hi, I'm Bradley Warner from Santorini Bay. Actually, I was a Cape Townian. I'm actually from out by Hangberg, and now I'm living in Santorini Bay, Lango. I'm also a local fisherman, and for years I've been a fisherman. For 35 years, I'm still a fisherman, and I'm still the man that you see now as a fisherman. And my only problem is I don't want my livelihood to disappear.
Yeah, a disappearing livelihood. And Maria, you join us from Rome today, where you normally live and work these days.
Yes, yeah, no, I'm not Italian, as you can hear. I'm also South African, born and raised in Cape Town, but living in Rome because that's where I'm leading the Coastal Communities Initiative for WWF, but familiar very much with what's happening in South Africa and really pleased to be able to talk about small-scale fisheries and the challenges they're facing here, but also how we can think about just making things better here, right?
Yes.
Yeah. We're really pleased to have you because you are leading this initiative on global level, actually. So you know the context within your home country as well as beyond, and that struggle is shared also beyond the borders of South Africa, obviously, but it's got its specific context, and we'll talk about both global and South African and the local as well. And as I understand, you guys only met today.
Yes.
And so some new friendships are being forged as we speak, and that's really nice. And I was wondering, Maria, because we chatted about this just a minute ago, what does that mean to you to meet people like Hilda or Bradley or Jerry or JP or Randall?
Yeah, it means a lot because my role is global, so I sit in an office, unfortunately, doing a lot of paper pushing, but only really this work becomes very real when you have FaceTime with people who are in the struggle at the front line and are quite clear about what they want to see happen on the ground. And so it's it feeds my soul and my passion. Honestly, it's the only reason I do this work is meeting with small-scale fishers directly. So, and especially happy to meet people from my home. So,
thank you.
And so Hilda, you and I were talking about just a minute ago also about what are the specific struggles within this common struggle that small-scale fishers have. And that's, if we had to pluck one word out of it, that would be access to your ancestral fishing grounds. In your experience and in your role, in your everyday life, how would you explain the struggle? What is the challenge and where does it come from and who does it come from?
Well, access is only one of just the many struggles. And as a child, I can't remember that we had any struggle getting to the sea, although we had to go with a tractor through gates and felt and sand roads and that. But the fishers went to sea. They went to sea with the small little vessels, mm-hmm. and there was plenty of fish. There were always abundance of fish. Yeah. But since the system changed, as from apartheid, we were suddenly not allowed to go there anymore. And because our elders were all afraid of the law, you know. They said, no, the law doesn't want us to do this, or the law doesn't want us to do this. We need to move. We can't fish there anymore. We have to go further down the coast, so that means it's more expenses. So access is still denied. We are, however, trying to get to municipalities and other authorities in terms of regaining that access. And it is a burden for fishers now having to go fish further away from their hometown, because fishing is in our blood and we wouldn't want to do anything else. We wouldn't want to sit in an office and do the daily office work. Our people want to go whatever fish they go fish for. That is regarding the access.
Yeah. You have been ousted from your place of abundance and made to find the way in the place that you're not familiar with and that you don't, where you don't want to be and where you don't want to fish. Bradley, how would you describe this struggle? Same as Hilda. Is there something else that you can talk to?
It's very big. The struggle was starting from when you were small and you see your parents, how they did struggle. That is the life. So my point of view is, when God made this water, who it belong to? It doesn't belong to government. But government bring rules that is not belonging to the fishermen. Our long belonging is our livelihood that is in the water. We live from whatever it is in the water. But now we have got rules. Government changes these rules. I've been working for how many years in the department, when they... Nothing came to whatever we want to. We approach them with everything that we got. We have this oil and gas that getting whatever they want to get. So this is all my disappointment from the department. How can I go and let my children also grow up like this? And for this time of view, everything is just all over is corruption. Mm-hmm. Corruption start at a department out and going to the parliament. Where does it end up? They come to us and say the communities is the corruption. But it's not the communities. This is our livelihood. We're killing our own livelihood from the start to the end. So this is where I say the struggle. I won't let my children grow up like this, because how can I put my children forward with this money, with whatever you call it? Money is the name. And this is where the struggle starts. You can't live without money. You have to buy a lot of stuff for your children. When they grow up, you have to send them to college. There's no money to send them to college because of the fees that we got. This is where we make our money. And everybody doesn't understand. Even the government doesn't understand the seawater like us. As I'm a local fisherman, I catch every day. Whatever I catch is whatever we... It's not every day a catching day, because every day it's there. It's a working day, but not a catching day. So if the fish is gone, the fish is gone. And then what must I do? I don't have a work. I don't have a pay slip. This is where I get my money from. So this is a struggle. They call it a struggle, but it's not a struggle. But there's a lot of other species that you can take, that you can harvest. But the government is making rules that is not supposed to be there. In the early years, when my mother and father was there, they had to go get crayfish. They can get acricots. You can get all these things from the rocks. But now they change it. They limited everything for us. So how can I still say I'm a fisherman? Because we got all of these things that was limited. Even on sea, the fish is also limited, but they give permits to people that's not supposed to be here by us. There's a lot of foreigners that's using our permits of South Africa to go harvest fish in other countries. So where does we start as fishermen? Yeah. So they're not acknowledging us. They're just using us like a piece of cloth. Mm. Wipe your face up and throw you gone. Yeah. That's how I see it.
Yeah. So the voices are not being upheld. Your needs are not being seen. And as Hilda, as you said, it sort of the apartheid government shaped it. And some things seem to persist still in your everyday life today.
Yeah, in my view, the apartheid laws are still there. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a fisheries management plan in our fisheries department. Should there have been a fisheries management plan, they would have looked at all other aspects affecting fishers. Mm-hmm. And the whole application process for fishing rights, we have our strong doubts about that. Mm-hmm. And we have been fighting since early, late 90s to be recognized. And eventually we were recognized, but not completely recognized within the Marine Living Resources Act. Mm-hmm. We have gone to court, won the Equality Court case, the fishers, to be recognized. So yeah, it's always a struggle to be recognized. We are recognized currently, but not quite. There is very little consultation, mm-hmm. almost like zero, between 0% and 5% consultation with us as fishers, as regarding implementation of certain acts, etc. And yeah, it's just been one big struggle. The co-management issue that is enshrined in the policy that have been co-designed with fishers. We are still shouting co-management now, co-management now. So within our different areas, there's also the no consultation in terms of the application for our small-scale basket, whereby we applied for the species. And some got and some didn't get. I told my co-fishers earlier, it was like a eeny, meeny, miny, moe. This is for you and this is for you. So much 5% for you and 100% for you. Mm. So we are very doubtful about the outcome of the rights granted for this current small-scale fishers co-ops.
Mm-hmm. So what's on the paper and what's on the ground are not quite the same thing.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's really, really, I really appreciate this. And thank you so much for chatting to us. Hello and welcome back to this special episode of the One Ocean Cup podcast. And we're talking with JP and Jerry, who come from KwaZulu-Natal. JP, can you tell us where you are exactly in case of any?
I'm from Durban.
Durban, okay. And Jerry, you're from Kozi Bay.
Correct.
Okay. And when we talked about your plight just a minute ago, we're just continuing some conversation that we had earlier in the day during the conference and the exhibition, you know, down at Bertha House. We were talking about a specific struggle or where you can pin it down. And JP, I remember you said that a big concern or heartache of yours is that you can only access your ancestral fishing grounds by obtaining a license for recreational fishery, and that you basically have to pay to access the place that you're going, and you're at the place where you and your family and your ancestors and you used to fish. Can you tell us how that reflects in your everyday life?
Okay. Firstly, I need to say that history states that back in the year 1860, there was a ship of indentured laborers, Indian indentured laborers, that came to South Africa. And because they had skills of farming and mining, they were brought to South Africa. So these indentured laborers was put in the sugarcane fields, right? So with that little pittance they've been earning, little money that they've been earning, they've opted to carve their own boat and took up fishing to sustain the living. So what has happened is, over the years, if I have to fast forward a coming back to my time. Right? I've been fishing for almost 57 years, from a seven-year-old boy. So I'm actually 63 now. I've been fishing together with the siblings, accompanying our dad, and going out to the beach to fish. But during the apartheid era, we have been displaced. We have been moved out under the Group Areas Act from where we had easy access to the fishing grounds and moved further inland. Apart from that, I've personally witnessed, feeling a bit emotional, but how my dad had been assaulted by the racist whites. And when my dad passed away, a group of fishermen, together with some family members, after he was cremated, part of his remains were taken and thrown into the sea at his favorite spot where he fished. And they even put a plaque on the rock in memory of him. So we've been facing a lot of struggles during the apartheid era. Although we are now 30 years into a democratic government, it seems like we're still living the past in the present. There's no change. And I'm saying that purely because currently the Department of Fisheries, they treat us like criminals. They do not recognize us for what we are worth. We are using a recreational permit, yet there are thousands of fisher folks who are unemployed, living below the poverty line. But it's not by choice. That's the only permit we could purchase at our local post office to use the fish. So we are saying we are not recreational fishers. We sustain a living by catching fish from the ocean to put food on the table and to sell and earn an income. We're not going there to just to enjoy the day and fish for leisure. So we've spoken to the Department of Fisheries to recognize us as subsistence fisher folks. That's what we need. They have listened to us. I might say it's work in progress, but everything seems to have been stalled. So nothing actually arises out of that request. Mm.
JP, thank you, first of all, so much for telling us this heartbreaking, but also cultural story, I guess. That's a story of crude injustice and violence and attempts at resilience. And still attempts to work with the government and with the former regime that gave that you feel substance in a way. Thank you also for on top of all that sharing the solution or what you think solution would be. I am going to ask you now what would be ideal, maybe, or what would you, in an ideal world, if will be granted tomorrow, what would you suggest?
Well, it's simple. To us, we feel that we should be inclusive when it comes to making decisions. They should not be sitting in isolation, having just marine scientists sitting with the department officials, and trying to impose regulations and restrictions and stuff. Mm-hmm. Right? We should be part of the stakeholder committee or the task team, because we feel that there should be no decisions for us without us. Mm-hmm. And if I may give you an example, they introduced a marine protected area, implemented, but they left the fisher folks out from the onset. There was no communication, no consultation, no participation. The draft implementation plan had went through to government, bring it into an act and gazette it. So we got in late to step in there. So how do you have all these things without us being there to discuss and help to make the decisions? The implementation of the marine protected area, we support marine protection because we want to see a sustainable ecosystem for future generations. There again lies a problem, a big gap, because they're not including us in co-managing that particular marine protection area. So we talk about co-management. We want to get involved. Mm-hmm. Community. Yeah. Get us involved. Mm-hmm. We should be there to observe what's going on. We can help monitor, manage that area so that we know we can provide information to the department and we can ensure the sustainability of our ecosystem.
You, for decades, as you said, with your late father, since you've been a little boy, and your community as well, has had habitual, embodied, place-based, transgenerational knowledge that was passed on down generations. You know this place, you know this environment, you know how these species work, you know all that, and you are not consulting with the knowledge that you have. And that's, I guess, an oversight on top of all of the other injustices.
The Department of Fisheries and the officials, together with marine scientists, they failed to realize the vast indigenous knowledge our fisher folks have. Right? We've been fishing without technology. We don't use fish finders from the rock and shore, surf fishing.
You know, right? What you're ready.
We know by certain landmark, we can judge the water, the wind direction, the wind speed. We can see which is the best place to fish. Right. Now, we should be regarded as citizen scientists with our indigenous knowledge. But the fact that we don't have a formal qualification from the institute does not mean that they should criminalize us. They should sit with us to sit together, collective, and make decisions. So we have knowledge. We can share with them. What they fail to do is to come on the ground and discuss with us and see our catches. But they sit behind the desks and behind the computers at the desk, and they want to impose restrictions or tighten up the regulations just to punish us.
Yeah. No, I also want to bring Terry in here as well, because I think you shared before a very similar problem where your knowledge and your research that you can actually undertake in your area of Causey Bay is missing recognition, is missing the ear of somebody who would maybe fund it. And also what is missing from your everyday experience is the access, full access to the Causey Bay, which is also the place where you're from. Can you tell us a little bit from your perspective, how does that struggle look and what would be something that you think would help alleviate it?
Yeah, Causey Bay, people were forcibly removed in the 80s. And we launched a land claim in 1995. To date, that land claim has not been resolved in a democratic South Africa. That has put very stringent in so many ways that the stakeholder government stakeholder, which is managing the area, is continuing managing the area on its own, while it's using the so-called, they call it integrated management plan, which is supposed to be inclusive, including us in charting ways of managing the place. Um, is not happening at Causey Bay. We have written numerous letters, emails to the departments, to the minister, to Ismangaliso, to our own Inkosi, and all those departments and people. They even failed to acknowledge having received our correspondences. They just ignore us. People, if you look at my age, I was born at Causey Bay, and the nature of the place is being used for their advantage, where they want, you know, to turn the place. There is a term which they use, the wildering.
Yes. Can you tell us a little bit about Causey Bay for those who don't know how Causey Bay looks and what it is? It is currently the first, it is recognized or known as the first UNESCO protected site of South Africa. But what is Causey Bay? How does it look?
Causey Bay is the name which was, yes, of course, imported from elsewhere, but it has got to do with the system, Causey Bay system, which is starting from the sea, Indian Ocean, and the system goes all the way to the four lakes and the stream called Siaja. It's a place where for so many years people have been living out of using the fish crawls to catch the fish. As JP mentioned, we are the people who have got vast indigenous knowledge as to when and how and what time can we catch the fish. But so many research work have been done. In one of the work which was done, you know, to suppress us, it puts our fish crawls into the category that fish crawls are not sustainable, which is
a traditional way of fishing.
Our traditional way of fishing, hereditary one from father to son, for more than 1,000 years. And then one comes say the fish crawl is not sustainable. Of course, we do want the government to, we do want to sit with the government and tell our story, to tell them our story, because as I'm the coordinator of the Causey Bay displaced communities, and they want me, you know, to get the government and the department to sit down and to talk about, firstly, this issue of land claim. We can't have a land claim, a claim which is sitting out there for so many years. Mm-hmm. What people want with their land claim, maybe to just immediately get into the solution. Mm-hmm. Two things. One is to go back and resettle into their forefathers' land, to enjoy all the rights which they were enjoying with the livelihoods of which are afforded to them by the land of their forefathers. Secondly, if somehow we talk and maybe agreed that because of maybe reasons that we can both agree that let's not go back and resettle, but at least have the rights over the land. That can ease the minds of the people, knowing that they are now in the state or in a stage where they can participate in whatever development is taking place. Quite right now, they are doing all the development without us. They do not consult, and we do not participate in their Bible, which is the Integrated Management Plan, which is very, very ironic to have such arrangement.
Yeah.
In the land claim elsewhere, it is expected that the people, the landowners should have should benefit out of all the developments taking place. Right now, it's not happening, and it has not been happening for so many years.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Jerry. So I would really like to bring you in here, Maria, just to ask you two questions. So from our chat for Kevin Kurds, from our friends here, and going back to what you and I chatted about just a minute ago as well, is that you are quite passionate, or you find it crucial in your work to regard the transdisciplinary partners, the co-designers of knowledge, the holders of knowledge, such as Jerry, JP, Hilda, Bradley, Randall, and others, small-scale fishers from South Africa and beyond. And of course, your perspective is global. Now, having heard a couple of these stories that the representatives of small-scale fishers in South Africa shared, how do you now feel that the transdisciplinary, so the traditional knowledge holders, what role do they play on the global level and in your native South Africa as well?
Yeah, thank you. I think it's very clear JP, Jerry, Randall, and Bradley and Hilda are very clear about what the issues are. And they're also very clear about what they see will work to make things work. Yeah, and there's a lot of complexity here in South Africa, in particular. It's a very very interesting context for us to bring sustainability into the small scale fisheries sector. For us to protect the last of our biodiversity and our marine resources. I think that the complexity here is that we need to treat this situation as a where we need to look through the eyes of small-scale fishers who have been living in an apartheid system, and that is what, and noting then that the solutions are clearly being brought to the table by these perspectives, that we can't just move forward with those solutions without acknowledging that this system is currently broken. And we would, and the passion and the determination is clear. So why are we not working with that energy and that passion? Because at the end of the day, as everyone said here, they've been living and this reality for thousands of years. Mm-hmm. And coastal stewardship comes from people who live on the coast, who've been facing this changing world for years. And we're not going to collaboratively manage these resources without them. So don't try, right? Mm-hmm. So I think, but I have hope, because it's good to hear you articulate your problems so well, but also steadfast, stay on course And I have seen this in many other countries around the world, young and old, women and men, very keen to conserve their environments, but also provide for their themselves. And I think that I have hope, because I think that that is voice already, the fact that there's so many, 160 million people around the world who are fishing, half of those women. And everybody wants collective action. And so I think that, and the solutions are there. They're maybe not always in front of you, but your colleagues around the world have implemented those solutions. And when you are sitting together like this, hearing from them how they've managed to resolve those issues, how they've managed to overcome challenges, then I'm hoping that that spurs you forward to keep fighting the struggle. And I think that that's the role that an organization like the one I work in, but several others, including the transdisciplinary community, can do. We can convene, we can talk about solutions, we can share them, we can research them, we can unpack them, but they need to be demonstrated to government. Because it sounds like only in this country, predominantly, we need to shift the views of government that it's possible, right? Mm-hmm. So, and organizations like ourselves stand ready alongside you as allies to demonstrate. I think that that's what's important, is that we play a role in helping demonstration happen, helping create places for speaking about these issues. But don't come in front of you to make the change, because it's only you who's going to make the change, right? So I think that that's it's just nice to be reminded of that. I'm very, very inspired by everyone's determination and passion, and it's a reason for us to keep working together, right?
Can you tell us anything about your experience perhaps with One Ocean Hub? What has worked so far? What can work better?
Well, there are four coastal provinces in South Africa that comprise our fisher folks. And this is where we really appreciate the intervention of One Ocean Hub to bring us in alliance with them, that we could sit with all fisher folks from a diverse range of fisher folks and discuss the challenges and the struggles that we face. So we learn from one another. Apart from the networking, we learn from them. And One Ocean Hub has the expertise in terms of research, also providing legal support for our fisher folks. And I don't think there's any other organization that has come on board to assist our fisher folks. So we're really grateful to be interacting with One Ocean Hub. And we know it's through them that the Department of Fisheries, including the minister, is now lending a ear to come and listen to us, because we could not do it alone. I don't know about the other organizations, but it is difficult to even get to the minister. But we managed to do it via the works of One Ocean Hub. So we're really grateful about it.
No, I think everybody across the One Ocean Hub and WWF and other organizations that tried to help would be thrilled to hear that. So we certainly are. Thank you so much for this. Thank you very much.
Hello and welcome to this special episode of the One Ocean Hub podcast. My name is Milica Prokic. I am a knowledge exchange associate at the One Ocean Hub. We are today doing something a little bit different because we're here in Cape Town at the closing conference of the One Ocean Hub. And with us today are some friends that we are really thrilled to talk to, who are the representatives of small-scale fisher communities of South Africa. And with us today is also Maria Honig from WWF. So we're talking about the common struggle of the small-scale fishers particularly in South Africa, but also globally, where Maria is going to help us to give us a little bit of context. And with us now is Randall. Randall, hello. You come from Eastern Cape, right?
Yes.
It's, what is the exact name of your place?
It's a small little village. It's called Kaaimouth. It's a tiny community, more of a holiday resort than anything else. But Kaaimouth is renowned for its fishing.
Cool.
I've been there for 23 years, but I'm a lifelong fisherman. My nappies were changed on the shores and on the boats, and I've changed my grandchildren's nappies on the shores and on the boats.
That's wonderful. And we heard a lot about the problems of access and the problems of rights and how they look beautiful on paper, but don't really aren't really implemented in real life in many places in South Africa, and how the abundance that people enjoyed before apartheid was somehow taken away. And then some struggles that happen today. What out of those do you feel in your everyday life, and what are the solutions that you could think of with your vast experience as a fisher?
Well, first of all, there's no doubts about it that we are still governed by an apartheid paper, which is the MLRA. It was developed way back 1940, and they're still shoving it down our throat. And I would say that what was part of the 2007 court order was that the government was supposed to implement co-management at that very young age, and they failed to do that. And a lot of people, I think most of the government doesn't understand co-management. It's what my colleagues were speaking about, is that our experience, it's like you've heard, some of us are lifelong fishermen and things like that, and people that are voted into power, into ministerial positions in our country, they don't have that knowledge. They voted into power for 3 years, or for maybe 4 years, or a term, or second term, or whatever it is, but they don't have that knowledge or that skill, or that they're not in that industry. So I don't see how a university degree person can talk to us about farming. When a farmer should talk to us about farming, it makes sense. So I'm not belittling our government or anything like that, but I would say that a solution would be to put people that are able, that have that capacity, people that have in-depth knowledge into the fishing industry, to be our minister.
Yeah,
and there are the advisory boards, and then you hear the people that are on these advisory boards. They don't really know much about fishing because they've got these degrees and stuff like that. And all of this, the way that they are implementing the thing, the way that they are doing things, it doesn't make sense. So that is why we are saying, come back to us.
Come back to us.
We're willing. We're willing to sit at the table, and we've been for years. It has been promised to us from 2015, flat out promised, that co-management will be implemented, and yet to this day it hasn't been implemented. And the co-management goes so far as to rewrite the laws and the whatever about the industry.
Yeah, so we're back to knowledge. And with all of the knowledge that you guys shared with us today, it's plain to see where it lies. It lies in people who actually live with the fish and with the ocean and with the boats and with the fishing equipment that's hundreds and thousands of years old and developed through generations. And everybody, each and every one of you today, shares that. For example, there is a forum such as the SSF Summit that's going to happen in July in Rome. And Maria, you're going to be there And having heard all of these stories and having heard the knowledge that comes from these guys here, what are your hopes in terms of getting across these messages? And what do you think these stories and this these experiences shared in this way can do on the forum such as that?
Yeah, it's a very good question. So earlier JP was saying, where we have meaningful dialogue is when we're sitting together with other fishers. Mm-hmm. And that is what the Small Scale Fisheries Summit in Rome is going to be. It's been going to be in 400 small scale fishers aggregating in one place, talking about the implementation of the Small Scale Fisheries Guidelines, voluntary guidelines, which is specifically identifies that some principles are fundamental to the small scale fishing sector, and some of them were talked about here today, like tenure and access and having a seat at the table and co-management. And I think what's powerful about having representation from 40 countries around the world talking and coming up with real asks of government is that critical mass, right? And coming together with one voice and being recognized for being 160 million people providing food for up to, you know, 20% of your protein, 2 billion people on the planet. I mean, these are can't be forgotten people. They are incredibly valuable to our economy and to the lives of 600 other million people day to day. So governments have to listen. And I think the Small Scale Fisheries Summit is a platform for this because it also precedes the Conference on Fisheries, which is the main regulatory UN body, happens every 2 years. And the fact that the summit precedes that means that we can come together with clear asks of our governments who are in the middle of making those decisions right there and then. So these are stories spoken about at this table, but together they amount to something much bigger than the single communities from which they come from, right? And so I think that the pressure must come from all sides, and our ministers will be sitting together, and if they hear that their neighbors, other important governments, champions of co-management, champions of, you know, adequate small-scale fisheries management, are doing well by making those decisions, then I'm hoping that that pressure is a positive one for the South African government in that context. So that's why I said earlier, we have to keep telling the stories, we have to keep demonstrating, we need to keep capturing those stories. Somebody mentioned expertise. It's really important that we bridge science with traditional knowledge, because traditional knowledge is exactly as you say. We understand the seasons, the change in the water, when the water is abundant, when it is struggling. Small scale fishers can do that, but scientists can also help us monitor, and scientists can also help us think about management plans and how to implement those and test tools of co-management. So I think that there is a place for both working together, but just don't stop.
Maybe not take over from the fishers, but maybe they can help. No, I'm sure there's a tremendous thing that can be done with collaboration. I would like to thank you very much, Maria, for sharing this. And yes, collaboration is key, of course, but also for coming to listen to these stories and to be a part of this conversation, because we heard so eloquently from several different people from South Africa who are small-scale fishers from different regions of South Africa. The messages seem pretty aligned. So I would like to thank also once again Randall, Jerry, Hilda, JP, and Bradley, and you, Maria, and everybody who listened to us today. This was the special episode of the One Ocean Hub podcast. Thank you very much, and talk to you next time.